Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, why aid to Egypt is so hard to figure out. Why back-to-school shopping is more than just pens and pencils. And Elmore Leonard on why Wall Street is boring. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday. It's the 20th of August, and it is great, as always, to have you with us. We are, we're not, we might, we won't, we have, we haven't. That about sums up the state of play in Washington today about aid to Egypt. Reports, rumors, more like really, were flying that the Obama administration has decided to cut off said aid. And then a State Department spokesperson gave what is, for now, the definitive answer.
We have not made a policy decision to suspend our aid to Egypt, period.
Period yet, one might reasonably add, seeing as how there are still high-level meetings going on at the White House on this topic. We asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill to dig into what exactly this aid to Egypt looks like and why it's so hard to stop giving it.
When we talk U.S. aid to Egypt, we're talking in the neighborhood of $1.5 billion, nearly all of it in military aid. The money goes into a bank account in New York, and Egyptian officials use it to buy equipment produced by American manufacturers. Things like
the M1A1 Abrams tank produced by General Dynamics. That's probably one of the most well-known items of equipment.
Shana Marshall is with George Washington University's Institute for Middle East Studies. Also, she says they buy F-16s, helicopters,
communications equipment,
missiles.
Also some items that are, you know, that would be used in sort of domestic crowd control situations.
Like tear gas. The U.S. also spends money to train the Egyptian military. Marshall estimates hundreds of members each year, including Egypt's military chief, General Azizi. Mark Lagan is a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown.
When you see the military putting down demonstrators and so on, you know, their training and some of their equipment is in fact underwritten by the United States.
So what's in it for the U.S.? Why has it been so hard to pull back? Lagan says one reason is that policy experts worry about Israel.
That Egypt making peace with Israel is something we want to maintain so that one of the fronts of instability for our closest ally in the region be kept stable.
Experts say there are other strategic reasons. There's a sense that aid equals influence. It builds relationships. The U.S. military also has flyover rights and gets expedited access to the Suez Canal. And lots of defense industry jobs are at stake, making those tanks and planes. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
The standard teenager social networking checklist, if we can change topics here for just a second, probably goes a little something like this. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, quite possibly. What about LinkedIn? Don't forget that. The giant and, dare I say, grown-up business networking site has lowered its sign-up age to 14. It's looking for the college and pre-college crowd with something called University Pages. Because, sadly, it's never too early to start worrying about your future, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishul reports.
You might think of LinkedIn as a place for networking, job searches, or just stalking job applicants, but John Hill sees it differently.
It becomes a directory of dreams.
Hill is the higher education evangelist at LinkedIn. He says the site's new University Pages help students and schools start the dance early.
We have the opportunity to help high school age students to identify the right university that fits what their interests are post-graduation.
Say you were thinking about going to UC San Diego. Well, you could look up its page and see that many alumni are in engineering and lots of them work at Qualcomm. That would work for you. So add UC San Diego to your list. Brandon Busby is director of outreach at UC San Diego.
LinkedIn has access to more folks than we likely do on the university side.
So not only can it help prospective students see beyond college, it can help them during college, says Trudy Steinfeld. She's with NYU's Career Center.
That is how students increasingly are going to get identified, if not only for jobs after college, but even for possible internship opportunities.
The flip side to all the education and career talk, though, is that young people are a huge growth opportunity for LinkedIn. The under 25 crowd is the site's fastest growing demographic, but still makes up only 15% of members. Susan Ettlinger is an analyst with Altimeter Group.
There just hasn't been a good sort of central place for young people to learn about universities, maybe outside their own geography or in particular areas of interest for them.
Just one note to future college students, save those pics from that party you weren't supposed to be at for Facebook. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You know the drill. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The crime du jour in this day and age, if that's not redundant somehow, is often of the cyber variety. Hackers get a hold of credit card numbers and bank accounts and then siphon off other people's money. Easy peasy, right? But what about good old-fashioned stick-em-up bank robberies? Whatever happened to them? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith went in search of the answer.
You've got to admit, there's something fascinating and exciting about bank robberies, which is probably why they show up in the movies a lot more than, say, check fraud.
Everybody freeze! Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As you can see, we are in fact robbing your bank.
That's Point Break, the 1990s cult classic about a gang of surfer bank robbers. Since then, the number of bank robberies has dropped by almost half to just over 5,000 a year.
There's still a huge number of bank robberies any way you look at it.
Retired FBI agent Jeff Lanza says every day the banks are open, about 20 are robbed, though it's not like Point Break.
The majority of bank robberies go like this. Someone comes in, passes a note to the teller. They say they have a weapon. Maybe they have a weapon. Maybe they don't. And they get money from one teller drawer, and then they leave the bank.
I had a note that indicated that I was armed, and my hand was inside of my jacket as though I was holding a gun.
That's convicted bank robber Ted Nellis. When he hit his first bank, he was a 19-year-old pool hustler who'd just gone broke.
I said to a gentleman, half-jokingly, why don't we just rob a bank? He said, sure, let's do it.
The two men robbed a bank in Calgary, Canada, strolled out into the street crowd, and 10 minutes later, boarded a bus out of town.
This was just incredible that I could do this and pull it off so easily and make a fairly decent chunk of change for 30 seconds to 60 seconds work.
Nellis and his partner each bagged about $4,000, and they got away. About 70% of bank robbers get caught the first time. Those who don't almost always go back for more.
Blew a lot of money on partying and whatnot. And anyway, we were broke again in, you know, like 10 weeks and began looking for another bank.
Nellis picked the bank his parents used and hid out in their home after the robbery. But Nellis's mom came home early from work, saw the men and the cash, and ran outside to tell the police. Nellis was sentenced to 5 years in prison. That was back in the 70s. These days, robbing banks is kind of old-fashioned, says the FBI's Jeff Lanza.
Bank robberies, the ones that are taking place now, are a crime for the less skilled who are not smart enough to commit identity theft or file false tax returns.
Criminals take in around $2 billion a year in check and debit fraud. Bank robberies, net less than $30 million. Not only are traditional bank robberies less lucrative, they're also riskier. Bank robbers are prone to making mistakes, like leaving fingerprints or bragging about the crime, says Sheriff Dale Radcliffe of York County, Nebraska.
A lot of them, after a while, they'll want to start bragging. They'll tell somebody.
Or everybody. A female bank robber Radcliffe was tracking last year posted a video of herself on YouTube, holding up a written note that she'd just robbed a bank and waving around a stack of $6,000 in cash.
Pictures of herself with the money and a video of her out on the web, and that made our job real easy.
Ted Nellis told his story in a memoir, Journey to Redemption. Since leaving prison more than 30 years ago, Nellis has started a successful cleaning business and works as a licensed minister and public speaker. He says it's hard to think back on his criminal days, though the skills sometimes still come in handy.
If I can walk into a bank and rob it in broad daylight, I can stand up in front of a group of people and talk.
Nellis says he's grateful his mom turned him in. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Elmore Leonard died today, as you've no doubt heard. He was 87 years old. He wrote 40-something novels in his life, including, just a couple of years ago, one about pirates in the Indian Ocean called Djibouti. We figured that was as good a reason as any to have him on, so we did. We had a nice little chat about the book, about how he writes, and about what he looks for in his characters. And then right at the very end, I asked him this.
So the financial crisis and the economy and the recession, I mean, there's got to be a book in there for you.
No.
Really? Oh, come on.
Where's the action?
Wall Street, center of the financial universe. Jamie Dimon is a bad guy.
I know.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, but I don't write that. My people don't have stock. I think it's the most boring thing in the world to make your money that way, using money to make money.
You don't think there's some, you know, entry-level person that you could find, you could make the... Oh, I don't know. I don't know why I'm pitching you a book.
Well, if you get a good idea, let me know
I'll do that.
Elmore Leonard from a couple of years ago. We've got the whole interview online. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
I walked through the lobby and I'd entered a crack den.
So, what was your first job like? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slid just a bit today, 7 points less than 0.1%, closed at 15,002. The NASDAQ queued up 24 points, 0.2%, 36.13 at the bell. The S&P 500 ticked up 6 points. It's about 0.3%, ended things at 1652. JCPenney reported stronger than expected back-to-school sales and hinted that the worst may be over for the struggling retailer. That drove the stock up 6%, but it's still at just a third of its 2011 price. Best Buy also seems to be turning around. The electronics giant reported higher profits thanks to cost-cutting. Its shares wired up 13% today. Wasn't all good news at the mall, though. Barnes & Noble said its founder isn't going to buy back the company's lagging brick-and-mortar bookstores after all. Off 12% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. A week-long celebration begins in the Capitol, leading up to the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Let's look at the health of the housing market. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for July. And finally, the excuse I've been waiting for, to travel to Finland. The Air Guitar World Championships get underway in Oulu. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. A detour now into the internecine, sometimes incomprehensible intersection of television networks and cable providers. That fight about the fees that Time Warner Cable pays CBS, specifically. Yes, the one that has Time Warner blacking out CBS and Showtime for millions of people in New York and L.A. and elsewhere in this country. Yeah, thing is, it's not going away. The standoff is in its third week and going strong. Strong enough that some Time Warner customers out there have had it. But breaking up is hard to do, as Kate Davidson reports.
It's a fact of modern life that a lot of breakups start like this.
I think I understood. You're calling to cancel or remove service. Is that right?
A couple days after the CBS blackout began, Nikki Muller of Burbank, California, tried to break up with Time Warner Cable because she was moving. She got caught in an unusually long queue.
Thanks. Please hold for a customer service representative.
Now, when we tried this today, we got through pretty fast, but Muller was on hold for 2 hours and 15 minutes. She says the worst part wasn't the hold music. It was the recorded voice reciting fun facts, like...
Did you know that the number pi repeats forever? Which just made it sound like they were making fun of you for being on hold forever.
Then the call disconnected. It's too soon to say if anecdotal reports of high call volume mean Time Warner Cable is losing lots of customers over the CBS spat. Mike Hodel is an analyst with Morningstar, and he thinks not. He says consumers are less likely to notice programming outages over the summer. It's the fall primetime season, and especially NFL football season, when they'll get mad.
Our feeling is that until you get to a point where there's real consumer pain, like you likely have around the football season, that both sides have an incentive to continue to push for what they want and not give in.
In other words, expect the brinkmanship to continue until September. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
four words to set up this next story: back to school shopping. As parents everywhere know, it's not quite what it used to be. Yes, there are shoes and clothes and pencils and notebooks, but increasingly, the shopping lists resemble stockroom inventories, and parents can easily find themselves shopping for a crowd. Sarah McCammon has that story.
If you have kids, okay, if you ever were a kid, you've probably been here, standing in the school supplies aisle, list in hand.
We have binders, pens, pencils, and loose leaf paper.
As her daughter grows, Julie Langley says so does the number of things she's asked to bring to school every year.
A CD-ROM, a flash drive. The only thing we don't need to buy is stuff for PE.
Langley's daughter, Kendra Thompson, is a seventh grader in West Des Moines, Iowa.
A lot of it's because of budget cuts, so it puts a lot of demand on the parents.
Demands like printer paper, dry erase markers, and cleaning supplies. More than a third of teachers have asked parents to help stock classroom supply closets, according to a survey by the National School Supply and Equipment Association. And the shopping lists just keep getting longer. Adrienne Dayton is a spokeswoman for the association.
Now the lists appear to be, 30 items, sometimes totaling, $50 worth of materials that really they're asked to bring right from the beginning if they can afford it.
I don't think I would have agreed to do it if the situation wasn't so dire.
Dan Lazar is the principal at Greenfield Elementary in Philadelphia. And the situation he's referring to is a $175,000 shortfall. Lazar is asking parents to pony up more than $600 per student this year. The money will be used to help cover everything from office paper to salaries for classroom assistants.
This is something I never want to have to do again.
Lazar says other Philadelphia schools are also asking parents to write big checks, and they aren't alone. In cities like New York, Lazar says parent-teacher groups often ask for hundreds of dollars per child.
My concern in all of this, and has been from the start, is those schools where the parents aren't able to give. And that scares me and it saddens me. Because those are our neediest kids.
Joanna Crane runs the school supply drive for needy families at the Red Rock Area Community Action Program south of Des Moines. She says the demands on parents start in preschool now.
Paper plates and cups and Clorox wipes and sanitizer.
She says it's just too much for some families, like Christina Dales. The 29-year-old mother of three recently came into the center to pick up free backpacks, pencils, and notebooks.
All right, I'll have you start over there, and as I... You said sixth grade.
Yes.
Three-ring binder.
Dale has a full-time job, but she says her kids' back-to-school needs can add up to hundreds of dollars she doesn't have.
Once you factor in the new school clothes, new shoes, the fact that they have to have a separate pair of shoes just for gym, and, regular shoes to wear, it gets very expensive.
And that's before you even get in the school door. Then there may be a whole new round of expenses.
There may be fees to help defray the cost of uniforms. There may be fees for additional courses that may be offered after the school day. They're all over the place.
Dan Dominich is the executive director of the School Superintendents Association, AASA. He says even though the economy is improving, schools haven't caught up. In states like California and Michigan, parents have sued to keep public school truly free, and they've won. But that just means more schools now ask for voluntary contributions. In Des Moines, Iowa, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Before the days of Angry Birds and Farmville, before even the days of Mario Brothers and Pac-Man, there was another game out there, mostly, though, for those of the nerdy persuasion. Dungeons and Dragons is what I speak of. Nerdy, perhaps, but also with some potential to be big business. David Ewalt is the author of a new book. It's called Of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons and Dragons and the People Who Play It. He is, for those of you who know what this means, a level 15 cleric. It says so right on the front cover. David, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
You are very upfront in this book. In fact, you are on the front of this book saying, hey, I play this game, and yes, it's a little geeky, but get over it.
Yeah, the game has a kind of odd reputation. It got this weird tinge of not only geekiness, but in the 1980s, it was lumped in with heavy metal and other things like that as a corrupter of children and possibly satanic.
Possibly.
Possibly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, there was a lot of hysteria because no one had ever seen a game like this before. Here are these books covered with pictures of demons and monsters, and there was like an easy conclusion to jump to.
Maybe what we ought to do is just give a primer, right, with the polyhedral dice and the role-playing and all that stuff. So give me like the 30-second elevator pitch for Dungeons & Dragons.
The way I like to describe the game is as collaborative storytelling. It's not a simple board game like Monopoly where you're moving a piece around a board and have a set goal. You're really sitting around a table with a bunch of other people and participating in an adventure that happens mostly in your heads.
The company that created and published this game, called Tactical Studies Rules, never did wind up managing to make a profit. About 15 years ago, it was bought by another company called Wizards of the Coast that are doing other games. It just, this kind of got buried in the corporate inertia, sort of.
Yeah, it's a really interesting case study of things that can go wrong with a startup. These are guys who were gamers, first and foremost. They didn't know how to run a company. And when the game exploded in popularity in the late 70s and early 80s, they suddenly had so much revenues and they didn't know what to do with it. And they spent it in a lot of really stupid ways. They invested in things like a company that made needlepoint kits just because they could. They ran into inventory problems very quickly and the company's finances crashed and burned and they had to be rescued in a buyout.
Do you have any sense of how big this game is? Not, you know, dollars and cents, but numbers of participants?
The best estimates is that probably somewhere between 30 and 40 million people around the world have played the game over the last 40 years.
And how many do you suppose, like, in a given year? I mean, is there a way to know that?
There's no real way to know, because the problem is even the publisher of the game right now, Wizards of the Coast, is owned by Hasbro now.
Oh,
they know
man.
How many
really?
Books. Yeah.
That must kill you guys, honestly.
It's good and bad. I mean, in one sense, it's, you know, it's sort of the empire coming in and buying out your little pirate ship. But on the other hand, they've got the resources now to put out some really cool product.
If Hasbro came out one day and said, we are going to create some iPad app version of Dungeons & Dragons, would that be a great thing for you guys? Or would it be... And I realize when I say you guys, I'm lumping you all in together, all the players of this game. Would it be a good thing or would it be sort of this week's sign of the apocalypse?
It depends on who you ask. And that's actually what's happening right now. Hasbro has realized that probably the most valuable thing in Dungeons & Dragons is the brand Dungeons & Dragons. It's
right,
not necessarily
right.
the role-playing game
right.
itself. And right now what they're doing is there is already a couple online versions of the game. They're releasing new video games, and they're pushing hard to sort of brand a broad range of fantasy-themed entertainment as Dungeons & Dragons.
Building that empire, man.
Yeah. It's just like the game. You level up after time.
That's right. David Ewalt writes on gaming for Forbes magazine. He also writes a book. It's called Of Dice and Men, about Dungeons & Dragons. David, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
We've been collecting stories of first jobs this week, the unusual and the everyday. Today's installment takes us indirectly to the Big Apple.
My name is Dream Hampton. I'm a writer and filmmaker living in Detroit. My first paid job was as a census taker in 1990. I just arrived in New York and I was making $10 an hour. And it was... first of all, a lot of money to me as an 18-year-old just arriving in New York City. But it also got me familiar very quickly with different neighborhoods. Being a census taker, I thought that I was doing a great service. Coming from the east side of Detroit, I knew what it meant to have funds diverted away from your community because you'd not been counted. One time, though, it was 1990, and the crack epidemic had certainly subsided, but it wasn't completely gone. And I went to this one apartment building in Central Harlem, and three or four guys kind of were guarding the door. And they said, are you sure that you want to go in there? And I was like, of course, you know, I'm from Detroit. I'm not afraid of an apartment building. I walked through the lobby, and I'd entered a crack den.
So I just started talking to people in between their using drugs and asking them where they lived and how many people were in their household, and assuring them that, you know, my taking this information for the census would help them get better garbage pickup. They were high, but they were sober enough to know that they still wanted services in their neighborhood. Now that I think of it, I learned a lot. That was good training because I never went to journalism school. So I think that taking the census as an 18-year-old was an excellent way to hone some pretty good interview skills and to get stories out of people who were absolutely unwilling to tell them.
Dream Hampton is a writer and a filmmaker. She lives, as she said, in Detroit. Tell us your stories of first jobs or anything you like, really. It's letters@marketplace.org, or you can tweet us at MarketplaceAPM.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, in which you learn once again that I occasionally have too much time on my hands. I found a survey online today. The URL, the address, pretty much says it all. www.whichfamouseconomistareyoumostsimilarto.com. All one word, needless to say. Answer a mere 105 questions, and the internet will tell you where you lie on the economic spectrum. Actually, it'll give you an idea if you answer just 20 of those questions. Fair warning, though, they are not easy, so be ready for that. We've got the link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And with that, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 7 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 24, that's 2/3%. The S&P 500 gained 8 points. That's about 0.5%. Thanks to Meg Kramer, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The interim producer of the Marketplace Morning Report is Sean Bowditch. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Let's do it again tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel. How about that? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.